And welcome once again to Health Dialogues and our discussion this hour about chemicals and our bodies. Each day, all of us are exposed to dozens, if not hundreds, of chemicals. Some are pretty obvious, like the ones in auto exhaust or oil refinery pollution. Others are more subtle, like the Teflon in your frying pan or the ingredients of toothpaste. And some of them actually save lives, like flame retardants on furniture, for example. Our question this hour is, how concerned should we be about these chemicals, and how do we limit our exposure to them? And we begin, of course, here in California. If you've ever been at work or in a restaurant or store and noticed signs warning of toxic chemicals, you've seen one effect of Proposition 65. The law, known as the Safe Drinking Water and Toxic Enforcement Act, was overwhelmingly passed by California voters 20 years ago this year. Prop 65 requires the state to publish a list of chemicals known to cause cancer, birth defects, or other reproductive harm. It also requires businesses to notify Californians if those chemicals are present. So, what effect is that law having in California? Our first three guests have different views on that. Joining us, Ed Weil, Supervising Deputy Attorney General in the Environment Section of the California Attorney General's Office. Michelle Korash, partner at Morrison & Forrester and head of the firm's Environmental Practice Group. And Jim Wheaton, president of the Environmental Law Foundation. Ed Weil from the AG's office, let me begin with you. Give us some common examples of chemicals that have ended up on the Prop 65 list.
Well, I think lead would be the number one example that's led to a lot of work in the area, but mercury is another important one, and a lot of solvents like trichloroethylene, paradichlorobenzene that you wouldn't recognize the names of, and then some common problem mixtures like diesel exhaust and tobacco smoke.
And they end up on that list, and what happens then?
Well, after a certain grace period, a company that knows it's exposing you to one of those chemicals has to either give you a warning about it or prove that the amount of the exposure is not enough to pose a significant risk. And also they're prohibited from discharging those chemicals into any source of drinking water, also unless they can prove that it would not pose a significant health risk.
And right now there are over 700 chemicals on that list. Who decides which chemicals make the list and when?
There is a committee of scientists appointed by the governor that convenes periodically to put chemicals on the list, and also the state, in effect, borrows from decisions made by other agencies, such as the International Agency for Research on Cancer, US EPA, in order to avoid kind of reinventing the wheel on these issues.
And so once it's on the list and these hazards have been identified, what happens then? What does the state of California do? What are businesses required to do?
Well, initially the state is actually not required to do anything. The businesses are responsible for being aware of the requirements of the law and deciding if they're going to warn or if they're going to remove the chemical from the product or if they're going to prove that the amount of the chemical is small enough that it's not an issue. The state, in several hundred instances, about 250, however, has actually adopted regulations that have defined how much of the chemical is permitted under the law.
Now, Jim Wheaton, from your perspective, what effect has Prop 65 and this notification process, what effect is it having on California?
Well, we think it's been singularly effective in reducing exposures to toxics and also educating the public. The reductions have often come because companies, rather than disclosing that they have a cancer-causing chemical in a common product, or perhaps it's a factory dousing its neighbors, will take steps to reduce the toxic chemical, either using substitutes, reducing the amount, doing what they can, so they don't have to give a warning. So you've got a positive public health benefit there. The other thing is the educational aspect. Often when a warning is given for a chemical in a given product, people will be surprised. I didn't know that there was lead in Grecian formula. I didn't know that there was acrylamide in potato chips, things like that. Then often people can make the choices that they want. And that's really the genius of the law. Rather than relying on a government agency to set all the levels and tell you what you can and can't do, it's simply an informational statute that gives people the information they need to make choices in the marketplace.
So there's really no enforcement there in terms of whether or not the product is on the market or not. I mean, it's strictly informational?
That's the intended goal. There is enforcement, but the enforcement is not to tell a company what they can or cannot do, what they must or must not put in the product. It simply says if there's enough to pose a significant risk, then they have to give a warning, and then it's up to the company to decide what to do. And then the enforcement is handled with a combination of the Attorney General's office, occasionally some DAs, but mostly by private enforcers who are out there busily testing products to see where the exposures are.
And give us an example in your mind. What would you say is a really a singular success of Prop 65?
I think I'd point to the presence of lead in the alloys that are used to manufacture plumbing products. Everything from familiar things like your sink faucet to valves to water meters and so forth. For over 100 years, the standard alloy used for plumbing products had 6 to 8% lead, much of which got to the surface and then leached out into your drinking water. After a series of Prop 65 cases that Mr. Weil really honchoed all the way up to the California Supreme Court, the industry has made a tremendous effort to change the alloys and to go to a lead-free alloy. It's been quite successful, not just in California, but across the nation.
Well, I was wondering about that. To what extent do these changes sort of start in California, but then sweep across the country and get picked up by other states just because California is so big?
Well, it's a common place that good environmental ideas like the weather move from west to east in the United States. And Prop 65 has had that ripple effect because often companies, when they decide to reformulate to reduce the exposures to the chemicals, don't do it just for the California market, but do it throughout their product line.
And Michelle Karash, I know you were an early opponent of Prop 65. In fact, you signed one of the original ballot arguments against it. Why was it a bad idea back then, and why has it been a bad idea since?
I thought it was a bad idea back then because of the way the law was written. Made no distinction between chemicals that truly pose a risk and products that really pose a risk and a product that simply contain an infinitesimal amount of ubiquitous chemicals.
What about the example that Jim Wheaton just gave of the pipes, for example?
The example he gave is an excellent one. I think it illustrates one aspect of Prop 65 that people need to understand, and that is it doesn't deal with risks that no one ever thought about. It's really a gotcha statute. It deals with risks that have been thought about and that have been addressed, and faucets and plumbing fixtures are a perfect example. There was an effort at the national level and at state levels to develop regulations that would, and in fact there were requirements, that would require changes in the alloys. Those alloys were being developed. And the reason that those cases could be settled in California is because the companies that made those fixtures had been working for a decade to develop alloys that would work. And by working, I mean that there wouldn't be leaks in the faucets.
So your point is that with or without Prop 65, that would have happened?
That would have happened.
Ed Weil, is that your impression that, in fact, most of the changes of so-called benefits that have occurred would have happened anyway?
No, that's not my view at all. And I think it's true that often what happens is Prop 65 provides some additional push to something that is being looked at anyway by the federal government or other states, but it's not moving quickly. And the way the laws work at the federal level often is that nothing happens until years and years of debate about exactly what level of lead is safe and what the level is going to be. And Prop 65 puts the pressure on these companies to either start disclosing or change the product. And in the case of the faucets, the standards that were being used by the federal government were very much out of date. They didn't reflect what we now know about lead being hazardous to children in smaller amounts than was previously thought. And our cases pushed that process along really by a number of years over how it would have been resolved otherwise.
But is it not also...
If I could jump in on that. It's interesting, Michelle points to other places it was being done, because the federal government actually had passed a law saying that lead-free means you can have lead up to 8%.
Jim Wheaton from the Environmental Law
Foundation. I'm sorry, yeah. And so to the extent that the federal government was working on it, they were working on it by going backward and saying, well, we'll just define lead-free as anything that has not more than 8% lead in it. So they were essentially legislating the status quo. And I had at least one plumbing company president tell me face-to-face, this California thing is going to drive the rest of the nation because we can't afford not to be in California.
What about Michelle's point, though, that these signs, these warnings, are so ubiquitous that, in effect, people don't even notice them. Their eyes glaze over.
That is a real problem, and I think there are warnings on buildings that don't do anything for people, and warnings on things like paint stripper that you know are hazardous aren't very helpful. But what we found is that any company will tell you that when it comes to food or personal care products, it's very different, and people do pay attention. And that's why we do find that you get companies that will not provide a warning because they know their customers won't want their products. We recently settled a large case with dozens of manufacturers of costume jewelry with lead who agreed to remove lead from all the products because they know that parents do not want to buy costume jewelry for their children with a toxicity warning on it. So warnings in the right place at the right time do mean a lot.
Michelle Koresh, what would you say? Prop 65 sounds like, you know, the Attorney's Full Employment Act. To what extent do you find that the lawsuits filed under Prop 65 are just frivolous?
Well, frivolous is a term of art in the legal business. But I do think that the lawsuits that are filed are, for the most part, driven as much, if not primarily, by the amount of money that can be obtained from the defendants as they are with public health concerns. And in fact, if you look at the settlements of Prop 65 cases, they are listed on the Attorney General's website, you will find that the vast majority of money that is paid goes to so-called attorney's fees for the plaintiff's lawyers. And in fact, these cases are brought by attorneys often on behalf of organizations that they have themselves created for the purpose of bringing these kinds of cases. And a lot of money goes there. And a lot of the cases, now, you know, that's a standard part of our system, which is to create financial incentives for lawyers to pursue actions that are thought to be in the public interest. But what's very troubling when you look at a lot of these cases is that they are not brought against companies that are in a position to actually affect the exposure. They are brought against companies that really can do nothing but settle or put up a warning that'll be just one more warning, like all the hundreds of thousands that are around the state. When you have a lawsuit which is brought against, let's say, the people who catch tuna fish, and there was such a case brought by the Attorney General's office, because the fish contain chemicals that are in the ocean, even according to the Attorney General's own allegations, that are in the ocean because of discharges by industries that are completely unrelated to fishing, or because of historical discharges in the Industrial Revolution that have traveled across the globe and into the oceans. That does not do anything to advance reducing the amount of those chemicals in the oceans or in fish.
Let me ask Ed Weil from the Attorney General's office, what is the purpose of pursuing a case like this as she describes it?
Well, the mercury in the fish can be harmful, whether it was put in there deliberately or it can be taken out or not. And even the Federal Food and Drug Administration agrees with us that women of childbearing age and children need to be cautioned to limit their fish consumption, especially certain kinds of fish that are very high in mercury. And so that's one instance in which, yes, the company can't remove it, but it's no less toxic because of that, and you need that information to make good dietary choices.
And wouldn't the FDA put that warning on the label or not, based on their judgment?
The FDA actually posts it on its website, and we simply wanted more or less the same information that FDA puts on its website to be posted in stores where people actually will see it and can use it in deciding should I buy the fish or the chicken or whatever.
Now, as you all know, Congress is considering a bill to give the FDA final say over whether the public should be alerted to any potential hazardous chemicals in food. The House passed it. It's going to go to the Senate. It's in the Senate. What impact would that have on Prop 65 and California's ability to regulate these kinds of things? Ed Weil?
Well, in the context of food, it would largely eliminate it because we would have to go to the federal government and ask their permission to enforce any additional requirements. They would, I can assure you, deny us that permission because philosophically they want uniform rules, and we would lose the ability to do things such as a recent case we did this year in which Mexican imported candies were coming in with large quantities of lead. We sued them. Those companies did not want to give a warning, did not think that everyone ignores warning, and they sat down and have worked out with us procedures in which a big effort will be made in Mexico to purify ingredients and protect people from that exposure, and FDA had not done anything with
Michelle that. Korash, isn't that an example, a good example, of how the law is working well for consumers?
If it were so, but I represented some of those companies, and that's just not my view of the case. The companies that agreed to settle the case were companies that were not the source of the problem in the first instance. They were multinational companies that had acquired Mexican candy companies and were, and in fact had, before the case was even filed, made changes to their operations to bring them up to their standards in the United States. So it was easy enough for them to agree to settlement terms. The hang-up was on the amount of money that they were being required to pay. And some of that money is supposed to be used to educate the hundreds of companies, probably thousands in Mexico, that make candy in their garage for sale in the Mexican market. And that stuff is then brought in across the border by people who, drive trucks over and bring it back and sell it here. So, yeah, it would be great if it actually worked the way Ed described it, but that's not what happened.
Ed Wild.
But the bottom line is the candies coming in from Mexico that people eat are going to have less lead in them, partly because of these companies and partly because of others.
Let me just add, Michelle Korash, I would assume then that you would support that bill in Congress that would take some of this power of Prop 65 away from California?
Well, I would, and it's unfortunate that it's needed. But food is a very good example of something that I don't believe the voters ever imagined that these Prop 65 warnings would apply to. You know, if you look back at the ballot arguments, they were all about big chemical companies spewing chemicals into the air and into our drinking water. As I said a moment ago, the cases that are currently pending would result in warnings on more than half, and perhaps as many as 75% to 80% of the foods that people eat and have eaten for years and have eaten in complete safety and which there's absolutely nothing wrong with. Why? Because they contain minute amounts of Prop 65 chemicals, many of them naturally occurring or natural byproducts of cooking foods.
Ed Weil, quick reaction, and then I want to get something. Jim Wheaton a question.
We have a case seeking warnings for a chemical called acrylamide in potato chips and French fries. Small amounts of acrylamide are present in large parts of the food supply, as Michelle says, but we aren't seeking warnings for that. And if we are making the distinction between the high dangerous amounts and much lower amounts that you don't need a warning about, right now, a serving of McDonald's French fries has 80 times the amount of acrylamide that U.S. EPA allows in a quart of drinking water, and we think people are entitled to know that. But it won't mean warnings on all the food that's out there.
Jim Wheaton.
I must say one thing in response to this. There is also a lawsuit that's not brought by the Attorney General. It's brought by a private party, entirely entitled to bring these claims, arguing that there should be warnings about acrylamide on a product called Wheatina. It's a hot cereal, which the FDA has allowed the company to label as reducing the risk of cancer because it has so much fiber in it. These Prop 65 plaintiffs want that same box to contain a cancer warning. That's nonsensical. That's what produces the kind of legislation that's pending in Congress.
Ed Weil, quick reaction.
But that's just the claim of the plaintiffs. Ultimately, it's very unlikely that a court is going to allow the results that Ms. Korash is concerned about.
A court will never hear this case because this is a small company showing that the product poses no significant risk is something that is done at trial. It takes 2 or 3 years to get there. It probably takes 7 figures of fees and experts to get there. And that is why, although there have been nearly 20,000 actions under Proposition 65, less than a dozen have ever been litigated.
Jim Wheaton from the Environmental Law Foundation, I want to ask you to respond to Michelle's two points. Number one, that the law doesn't distinguish between real risk and the mere presence of something. And secondly, that it's basically a shakedown of smaller companies because or bigger companies that will settle and end up putting some money in the pockets of attorneys.
The idea that it does not distinguish is simply false. The law actually says that where there is no significant risk of cancer, no warning is required. There's a very bright line. It's established by science. There's a safety factor, and these things are determined, as Mr. Weil said, by the state scientific experts who have set over hundreds of levels where there is a risk versus where there's not a risk. So the law actually does distinguish. The second part of it, that to the extent that companies feel it's a shakedown, every company that ever gets sued for breaking the law says, gee, I didn't do it.
But would you agree that there are frivolous lawsuits?
I believe that there were some, and then the legislature, taking the power it had, amended the law to create some pretty serious barriers to frivolous lawsuits, both at the outset and also at the back end. And we've seen many companies that say, oh, we didn't know, we understand, we'll fix the problem. But what ends up happening often is they go in, they get milked for frivolous defenses, they get dragged out in the courts for a year or two because the defense lawyers are not going to let them settle, and then they end up after having been milked for a few years, they come back in, they get exactly the same settlement they would have gotten at day one with no fees.
Michelle Koresh, would you respond to the substance of what Jim Wheaton is saying, that in fact there is a distinction in the law between levels that are harmful and ones that are not?
Yeah, there is a distinction in the law. There is a no significant risk defense. And what I said is not that the law doesn't distinguish. It is that the law as applied, and in fact as it must be applied given the way it's written, makes it irrelevant that there is a no significant risk defense. It is irrelevant that there is a defense for naturally occurring products. It's irrelevant because the only way a defendant gets to mount that defense, and the only time that defense is heard, is at trial. And as any lawyer, whether they're plaintiff or defendant, can tell you, and whatever the reason for it is, that a trial ordinarily occurs 1 to 3 years after a complaint is filed. There is massive discovery. There are huge amounts of time that go into the case. And most companies make the economically rational decision that they would rather settle, write a big check, continue whatever it is they were doing about the particular product, maybe expedite it a little bit, and go back to business. So the reality is that if one of these listed chemicals is detectable in a product, either a company is going to post one of these warnings that I think we all agree don't provide a whole lot of information, or they're going to face a lawsuit, and when they do, they're going to settle it.
Ed Weil from the AG's office.
It is an unfortunate part of our system that every law, including this one, often results in people settling cases rather than the expense of a trial. But I'd like to add that the Attorney General for the last several years has spent a good portion of his resources on, in effect, policing unscrupulous private plaintiffs, objecting to their settlements, discouraging them from filing lawsuits. And we have had some success, although not what we'd like, in cutting down on the number of abusive lawsuits.
We are short on time, but I want to end by asking each of you, starting with you, Jim Wheaton, how would you like Prop 65, what would you like it to look like 5-10 years from now? Are changes needed?
Oh, you'd always like to see a law that gives consumers information and protects them in the marketplace to be stronger. But quite frankly, I think it's done very well over 20 years, and I think it's going to do very well over the next 5 or 10, particularly as it moves into foods, unless Congress decides to hide the ball from people.
Michelle Koresh.
Well, I'd like to see a couple things. I'd like to see the Attorney General with the authority to, and the willingness to exercise that authority, to exercise more control over the private cases that go forward. I hope we all agree that there are at least some that are pretty frivolous. And I also think that where you've got highly regulated products, like food, which is regulated both by the State Department of Health Services and the FDA and the USDA, that there is no need for this additional layer of often conflicting state regulation.
All right, Ed Weil, final thoughts from you.
It needs to be there as a very useful supplement to fill gaps in the existing regulatory network, not as a replacement for it. And ideally, I would like to see less warnings, but better, more focused, useful ones, and maybe a little bit less money going to my brethren attorneys.
Ed Weil from the California Attorney General's Office, thanks to you. Thanks also to Jim Wheaton, President of the Environmental Law Foundation, and on the phone, Michelle Korash, Partner at Morrison & Forster. Thank you all.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
And coming up in the next half hour, we continue our examination of chemicals in our bodies. We'll be looking at how new chemicals come to market, the role of government regulators, and how to place all this information into some kind of perspective. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Health Dialogues.
From routine dental work to complicated heart surgery, more and more Californians are traveling abroad to get less expensive medical care. At the same time, people from other countries continue to seek specialized care in the United States. What are the financial, legal, and medical implications of such health care beyond borders? We'll explore medical tourism next month on Health Dialogues.
And now we continue our conversation on Health Dialogues. I'm Scott Schaefer. In the first half of the show, we talked about the impact of Proposition 65, the law requiring businesses to post warnings when toxics causing cancer or reproductive problems are present. There are nearly 800 chemicals on that list now, but that doesn't mean they're not widely used. In fact, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has found many of them in our bodies. Scientists are trying to understand whether this daily soup of chemicals poses a danger to our health. Sarah Varney filed this report.
My annoying alarm clock goes off. I stumble a few feet to the bathroom, pull back the vinyl shower curtain, turn on the faucet, and... okay, I'm turning this microphone off. Toothpaste, shampoo, conditioner, face cleanser, moisturizer, deodorant, hair goo. I've gone from sleepyhead to civilized human being with the help of no fewer than 200 chemicals. And it turns out, when I do this routine, day after day, year after year, tiny amounts of these synthetic and natural chemicals accumulate in my fat, tissue, organs, and bones.
The ways that people get exposed to chemicals or take in chemicals is that they cross permeable barriers in the body.
Dr. Amy Kyle is a research scientist at UC Berkeley.
Your skin is permeable to things that are lipophilic or that tend to dissolve into fats. Your little alveoli in the base of your lung, where you absorb oxygen, through that barrier you can absorb certain kinds of more water-soluble chemicals. They just cross that barrier and then go into your blood there. And then in your gut, through the membranes that separate your gut from your body, things can be absorbed there as well.
Some of these chemical compounds stay in our bodies only briefly. When you bring dry cleaning home, for example, you breathe in volatile cleaning agents, but pretty quickly exhale them out. But other chemicals, like lead, can stay in our bodies for decades. Still, other compounds, like flame retardants, can cross a pregnant woman's placental barrier.
And what we're after here is chlorine, because that's what...
In a lab at the California Department of Toxic Substance Control in Berkeley, Dr. Mirto Petraeus holds up a pink vinyl lunchbox. A perky princess named Berry Dazzling smiles on the lid. Dr. Petraeus presses a portable X-ray machine against the lunchbox to measure the elements in its surface.
So what we see here is, and I need my glasses, but we have about 10% of chlorine in the product here. So whatever the composition of the surface, has some chlorine in it. It's probably PVC. We know PVC, it's polyvinyl chlorine. It also has lead.
Do we know how much?
Yes, it has 520 parts per million, which is quite a bit.
When the Berry Dazzling lunchbox sits on a shelf, the lead doesn't leach out, says Dr. Petraeus. The problem is elementary school lunches can be messy affairs.
If you think a little girl having some orange juice spilled, then, you know, this is acidic, and this may leach out the lead or licking your fingers after touching your orange wedges or something, it's not a good idea to have lead in your kid's lunchbox.
Researchers know trace amounts of hundreds of chemicals are getting into our bodies and into developing fetuses, but scientists don't exactly know what that means. Most of what we know about chemical exposures comes from animal studies. Researchers expose rats to a very high dose of a single chemical, much higher than we'd get in our daily lives, says UC Berkeley researcher Dr. Kyle.
They're looking for what might give 1 in 100,000 or 1 in 1 million people cancer. So they can't test that many animals, so they have to test them at higher doses. And that has led to a whole series of issues about how to extrapolate or extend those test results for what they mean in people.
It's difficult to simulate in a lab the thousands of exposures that we experience, many times to a mixture of chemicals. Some clues are beginning to emerge, though. University of Rochester obstetrics and gynecology professor Shauna Swan tested the phthalate levels in the urine of pregnant women in Los Angeles and two other U.S. cities. Phthalates are widely used in shampoo, paints, and many plastics, from shower curtains to water bottles to pacifiers. In rodents, phthalates have been shown to depress testosterone levels during fetal development.
What we know is that the default sex is female. And in order to convert the pups in utero or humans in utero to males, there has to be this process of masculinization that takes place. And if testosterone is reduced, that can be incomplete.
One measure of incomplete masculinization is the distance between the genitals and the anus, or the anogenital distance. Normally, that distance is about twice as long in males as in females. But male rodents exposed to high levels of phthalates had shorter, more female-like distances and were at greater risk for testicular tumors and low sperm counts. In Dr. Swan's human study, she found that the baby boys whose mothers had higher phthalate levels also had a shorter anogenital distance. The big question, says Dr. Swan, is what this means as the boys in her study grow up. They're now 6 years old, and Dr. Swan is studying whether their play behavior is typical for their gender.
Are we looking at something that will really have a profound effect on their lives? Are we just looking at something which is a couple of millimeters difference one way or the other, which is a who cares? My hypothesis that it's important is based on the rodent data, but we really need to confirm that.
For Health Dialogues, I'm Sarah Varney.
And joining us now to talk more about these kinds of chemicals and what exposure to them means are Bill Walker, Vice President of the Environmental Working Group, that's an advocacy organization, also Dr. Richard Jackson, Adjunct Professor of Environmental Health at UC Berkeley's School of Public Health. He's also a former director of the National Center for Environmental Health with the CDC. And also joining us by phone, Mike Walls, Managing Director of Government and Regulatory Affairs with the American Chemistry Council. Dick Jackson, let me begin with you. As we said earlier in the show, some of these chemicals are obvious, so that they're going to be dangerous to us, things like Agent Orange, nicotine. But what about other chemicals that are found in smaller amounts and whose effects may be more subtle? How do we decide what level of exposure we should be concerned about?
You know, I come out of the public health world, and what the CDC has done is actually profile 5,000 people every single year for their exposure to things that we eat, the normal part of our diet, but we also look at chemicals in people's bodies. And so we're trying to take diseases in people and then track back what may be some of the things in the environment that are associated with these illnesses. There are so many chemicals in use, 100,000 chemicals in use. There's no way that someone can do all the toxicology tests to assure that every single one of them is normal. And one of the things we need with this ability to look at people is to be able to respond to clusters of cancer and birth defects. We call it biomonitoring, and that's one of the tools that is being brought to bear here.
And what does that entail, biomonitoring?
Biomonitoring, in essence, is, it's pretty easy to look at very high-level amounts of chemicals in people, but to be looking at very small amounts in hundreds or even thousands of people, and then profiling the population and looking what's a hot spot for the chemicals, what's a hot spot for people with certain gene backgrounds, what's a hot spot for people with on various medications, and to be able to look at health outcomes as they're associated with exposures in the real-life population, not in test animals or not in a few test subject human beings.
Well, in fact, Governor Schwarzenegger this year signed a bill that will help the state track chemicals in our bodies through that kind of biomonitoring on volunteers. Bill Walker, what kind of information are we likely to get from that?
Well, we're going to find out what sorts of chemicals are actually found in the bodies of Californians. And as we gather a larger sample, we'll be able to look and see whether there are regional differences, ethnic differences, age and sex differences, even income differences. And it's going to be key to trying to establish exactly what chemicals that are found in the human body, because these biomonitoring or body burden tests confirm that there are hundreds of industrial chemicals in all of us, and that even babies enter the world with hundreds of industrial chemicals even before they've been out in the environment. It's going to enable us to try and, as Dick said, match chemical exposures to patterns that we see emerging in diseases.
But you could have a high level of, say, mercury in your blood or in your body after eating, say, a lot of tuna fish for a few days.
Right.
How long would these chemicals or that chemical stay in your body, and what difference does that make in terms of what assumptions we make and what policies we might develop from that?
Well, mercury exposure is very well established with almost immediate health effects in adults. Loss of libido, hair loss, general fatigue. A study done right here in San Francisco by Dr. Jane Hightower. She found that a number of her rather upscale, affluent customers were exhibiting signs of mercury poisoning. She surveyed them as to their eating habits and found out that these were people who had a high intake of seafood. Now, the good news is that she was able to see the mercury levels in these populations drop rather dramatically as they reduce their intake of seafood. So there is a very practical application to knowing what is in your body and knowing where it might have come from.
But at the same time, we're also told that eating seafood is good for us.
That's absolutely true. You may need to make selections of seafood that are lower in mercury and lower in other types of chemicals that we're finding. And that's why the things such as Proposition 65, far from being frivolous, can help us make the consumer choices that will enable us to eat healthily and choose the right things while at the same time avoiding the wrong things.
Mike Walls from the American Chemistry Council, your industry opposed other versions, earlier versions of the bill that the governor ended up signing this year. What did you object to?
Well, I think that, first of all, there's a couple of points I'd like to make on this. First of all, it's not surprising that chemicals are in the human body. I mean, human beings are chemicals in motion. The human body produces chemicals, produces many of the chemicals that are indeed synthesized for commercial purposes. I think that with respect to the particular benefits of biomonitoring, our industry agrees that there's a need for this type of tracking and surveillance program, including the one signed into law by Governor Schwarzenegger. But the point is that it's still only a health tracking system. No associations have been made yet or are capable of being made yet between cause and effect. What these are, what we will develop through this information is information on chemicals being detected, and that will lead to hypotheses for additional research. But they, in and of themselves, they don't match exposures to disease patterns. And in fact, the CDC has said that the mere presence of a chemical detected in the body is not an indication that there's an adverse health effect.
Dick Jackson, your reaction to that?
We've learned, for example, years ago we said, well, kids were not more exposed to pesticides in the diet. Then with biomonitoring, we found that children actually had higher levels because they eat, drink, and breathe more. We then said that people that eat organic diets do not have different levels from people who eat regular diets. And with biomonitoring, we now know that if you eat an organic, so-called organic diet, you have lower levels of chemicals. We continue to be surprised by the things we learn in the world of biomonitoring. We were surprised when we looked at the U.S. population that phthalate levels were much higher in certain subgroups in our population than we expected. The critical thing here is to take an honest snapshot of what is going on in the American population and I think make decisions based upon real data. And for many of these chemicals, I want to see the levels going down, not going up, and I don't want to see higher levels in children.
Mike Walls, is that a good goal to see the
absolutely
level?
Absolutely, it's a good goal. We don't want to see higher levels in children or in anybody for that matter. I think it points to an important thing about the type of program that the CDC has underway and the type of program California will develop. And that is, for the first time, we'll start to pull together trend information that will allow us to make some judgments and do the additional research on what are the sources of those chemicals, for example, and what measures might be taken to mitigate potential exposures.
Bill Walker, how concerned are you that as we get more information about the kinds and the levels of chemicals in our bodies, that people are going to sort of turn off to it? You know, it's going to become a ubiquitous warning and sort of like the signs with Prop 65 that we were talking about earlier, that people either, you know, how do you balance the risk and the benefits of something like breastfeeding, for example?
Far from turning off to it, we find that people are intensely interested to find out what their body burden of industrial chemicals is. And it's the ultimate right to know issue in a way, the right to know what chemicals are in my body. And you'll often find manufacturers and the industry saying such things as that it's these doses are so small that it's nothing to worry about. Well, there are two responses. First of all, people are telling us, no, thank you. I don't want the industry, or for that matter, a government agency, telling me that a little bit of this poison is okay. I'd prefer not to have any poison in my body, or I'd prefer to at least have the option of deciding that I don't want that product.
But is that reasonable given how prevalent these chemicals are in virtually every aspect of our lives?
Well, it's no debate at all the fact that chemicals are ubiquitous in our environment and they're going to continue to be. But what we've been doing for the last roughly 50, 60 years since the advent of the chemical revolution in the 50s is conducting a vast experiment on the human population. My grandfather did not have these chemicals in his body. Your grandmother did not have these chemicals in her body. And we're now exposed in so many different ways to chemicals, the great majority of which have not been adequately tested for safety. Most people do not realize that the federal government doesn't even have the right to require safety testing on chemicals. And in many cases, we don't know the health effects of the individual chemicals, but even more than that, we know that chemicals in combination can cause different effects, and these combinations have never been tested for their health effects.
Mike Walls, to what extent are we allowing chemicals to come to the marketplace in the United States without really knowing what the health consequences, either individually or in combination with other chemicals, is?
Well, several comments on that. With all due respect to Bill's grandparents, I mean, the fact is that we don't know what chemicals they had in their body. We didn't have the technology to detect the presence of chemicals in the minute amounts we are now capable of doing. So, I mean, it's important to realize as the technology develops and we get better and better at detecting smaller and smaller amounts of ever-increasing amounts of chemicals, including the chemicals produced by the human body, we're going to have a better idea of what's there and where it came from. Now, as was noted earlier in your program, urban air pollution is a chemical exposure. To what extent is that responsible for the chemicals showing up in the body? Well, we're starting to find that out. Now, in terms of the point I'm trying to make there is that commercial chemicals in and of themselves are not the source of exposures to these chemicals. Now, the U.S. has the Toxic Substances Control Act in place at the federal level, and that's a robust, remarkably adaptable statute that helps ensure that new chemicals put on the market in the United States do have the necessary health and safety data and use and exposure information that assures that we can appropriately control exposures and manage the risks from those chemicals.
Dick Jackson, from your perspective, does the federal government have the regulatory power it needs to make sure that these chemicals are safe?
I've had multiple thoughts from listening to all of this. One is our grandparents did not have Teflon derivatives and fluorinated compounds in their bodies. So there's really a need to scrutinize what's there and make sure the levels are going down over time. There is a positive story, which is the removal of lead from our environment has decreased our average blood leads from about 22 down to less than 2, with huge benefits to health, well-being, blood pressure, hearing, dentition, and intelligence in our population. And the measurement of what's going on in the population and then documenting that the public has made, society's made the right decision in getting rid of this is very, very important. It's the 21st century, and I do think the Toxic Substances Control Act has become outdated. We need to move towards a decision that we're going to put chemicals into our environment that are safe rather than a thought process that says we'll let them be out there until we can prove that they're a hazard. Now, none of this is going to happen overnight. It's going to take a generation or so to make this happen, but we need to be moving in the right direction.
Bill Walker.
I just want to add one thing. The continuing characterization, as we're all doing here today, of these amounts we're detecting as minute amounts or trace amounts, indeed they are, but what that puts in the mind of many people is the idea that you often see repeated by the chemical industry, that the dose makes the poison, that even aspirin can hurt you if you get too much of it. Well, that's not universally true. Research has been showing us in recent years that a very small amount of the wrong thing at the wrong time, particularly during fetal development, can cause serious problems later on in life. So we simply can't take it as a given anymore that a minute amount of a chemical is harmless.
Dick Jackson, I'm not...
Just
go ahead, Mike Walls from the Chemistry Council. Yes.
Bill's right. We can't take it for granted. We need the research there. But it's also true that when you drive by the Outback Steakhouse and you smell that steak on the grill, it doesn't mean you've eaten the whole steak.
Meaning
that you've had an exposure, a chemical exposure to the smell of that steak, but you haven't eaten it.
Yeah. Europe is moving toward a different sort of regulatory process, which can be summed up more or less by no data, no market. In other words, it puts the onus on business before these chemicals can come to market. Mike Walls, what do you think of that sort of approach?
Well, we think Europe is taking an unnecessarily stringent approach. In fact, they're taking an approach that's based more on regulating on the basis of hazard rather than regulating on the basis of risk, which is the foundation for our regulatory system here in the United States. In fact, I'd note that Europe's system is not final. It's not law yet, hasn't been implemented, it's unproven, hasn't been the basis for a regulatory decision yet, and won't be for 3 to 4 years out in the future at best. But what they're setting up is a system that changes the regulatory paradigm to say, look, if you don't have the same information about all chemicals, one, you don't have a market, and two, if you have a chemical of particularly high concern, say a carcinogen, then you have to prove that no substitutes exist for that chemical before you can use them, irrespective of the actual risks of using it in that particular product or process. Now, and under our system, we don't require all chemicals to have the same amount of information, and that's because use and exposure patterns differ. And the tests required to provide this data are important, are expensive. But what the chemical industry has done over the past 5 years through our High Production Volume Challenge program, which we developed in cooperation with EPA and Environmental Defense, we've provided basic hazard information on 2,200 chemicals, over 95% of the chemicals in commerce by volume in the United States. That program's a good start. EPA is using that information now to prioritize its regulatory approaches to those chemicals, and ultimately all that information will be available on the web.
Dick Jackson from UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Do you think the EPA has the power it needs currently, or should we be moving more toward a model like the European Union seems to be moving toward?
You know, I've done over 25 years, I've gone to endless public meetings, and the public has said, I don't want lead in my bones, I don't want perchloroethylene in my liver, I don't want perchlorate in my thyroid and the rest. I think the public is demanding for more aggressive accountability from government, and the government processes on many of these are extraordinarily slow, litigious, and cumbersome.
Mike Walls, to what extent can the chemical industry adopt, is there such a thing as green chemistry? In other words, developing chemicals in ways that are less harmful to the environment and to people?
Well, in fact, the American chemical industry is one of the original practitioners of green chemistry, and I'd note green engineering. Our industry is regularly recognized by the Presidential Green Chemistry Awards for its contributions. We're investing $23 billion a year in research and development. One out of every four patents granted in the United States are related to chemicals. We are bringing new products constantly to market, and our regulatory system, I'd submit, helps promote that level of innovation. We file over almost three times more new chemical applications in the United States than they do in Europe, for example. And that's a fundamental indicator of innovation.
Bill Walker from the Environmental Working Group. But what would you like to see in the next few years, in addition to these biomonitoring efforts to continue? What would be most important to keep people safe and to sort of protect us?
Well, there's been legislation introduced, which is called the Kids Safe Chemicals Act, of which Senators Boxer and Feinstein are both co-sponsors, that essentially would reverse the burden of proof. Most people don't realize in this country that essentially what we've got is a system in which chemicals are innocent until proven guilty. That may work just fine for the human justice system, but with chemicals, it's taking a real gamble. And what we need to see is the Toxic Substances Control Act reformed into a true environmental health protection that says that chemicals must be affirmatively proven safe before they're allowed to market. We're going to concentrate on those chemicals that affect kids, and we're going to concentrate on those chemicals that are shown to be building up in the human body.
And would you grandfather in all the chemicals that have already been approved?
Absolutely not. There are something like 63,000 chemicals out there that were grandfathered in when the Toxic Substances Control Act was passed, and very few of them, only a couple of thousand, I believe, have now, they've gone back and done the required kinds of tests that we'd like to see.
So there could be some changes in terms of what's allowed, what's not.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, I want to thank all of our guests for this discussion this hour. Bill Walker from the Environmental Working Group. Also, Dr. Dick Jackson, adjunct professor of environmental health at UC Berkeley's School of Public Health. And also with us on the phone, Mike Walls, Managing Director of Government and Regulatory Affairs with the American Chemistry Council. And if you missed any part of our discussion, or if you want to listen to past programs, go to our website. It's californiareport.org, and you just click on Health Dialogues. You've been listening to Health Dialogues, a production of the California Report and KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. The engineer is Danny Bringer, with additional mixing by Seal Muller and Howard Gelman. Eric Gillespie is the outreach manager. Special thanks to our intern, Lisa Morehouse. Our web content editor is Alex Porcaro. David Minko produced the show. Senior producer of Health Dialogues is Andrea Kissick, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report's Health Dialogue series are provided by the California Endowment for coverage of healthcare in California and the members of KQED Public Radio.